Hi, I'm on with Jim Rogers from International Investor from Singapore. How are you today, Professor?
I'm great. I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks very much. I just read an article you wrote about buying farmland. How did you come to that decision?
Well, as I look around the world, I see that agriculture has been one of the worst businesses in the world for the last 30 years, which leads me to do a little more research, and I realize that we now have problems, serious problems developing in agriculture, which you too can easily figure out. And unless prices of agricultural products go up, we're going to have disaster in the world. We're going to have no food at any price in some places. So you're going to see higher and higher prices, better and better returns for farmers. You're going to see a whole different world for agriculture. Otherwise, we're going to have the end of the world as we know it. The inventories of food are the lowest they've been in several decades. We have shortages of everything, fertilizers, tractors, tractor tires, everything in the agricultural world. We even have a shortage of farmers developing. So it doesn't take much to realize that farming has to get much, 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 much better, or the world comes to an end.
I was just reading John Steinbeck of Mice and Men, living off the fat of the land, you know, as a commodity trader. It might make sense for me to go to Nebraska, find myself a little corn husker, start growing yellow soybeans, and, you know, if times get tough, I could always live off the kill here.
Right. Well, people have done that for a few centuries, for many centuries, as a matter of fact, so that may come to that again.
Yeah, coincidentally, Steinbeck wrote that book in Depression-era California, where I am, in 1937. So I feel like I'm channeling him a little bit now in Depression-era California, 2009. Here in the U.S., we're rolling out dollar bills like they're paper towels, like Viva. Is hyperinflation a foregone conclusion for us here in the States?
Well, throughout history, when governments have printed gigantic amounts of money, it's always led to higher prices. And in this case, the United States is printing not just gigantic, but stupendous amounts of money. I mean, there's never been anything like this in world history. Well, except maybe someplace like Zimbabwe or something where, you know, things totally collapsed. This is the only time in world history, too, when you have nearly every government in the world printing lots of money. So I see no way to avoid the fact that we're going to have much higher prices down the road. And it's partially compounded by the fact that we have supply problems developing in all raw material areas. We talked about agriculture just now, but mines are being depleted, oil fields are being depleted. So we have shortages developing of everything at a time when governments are printing money. That's going to lead to higher prices. I hope everybody will protect themselves or prepare themselves, if nothing else.
Back from what I remember, you know, and I was a little bit young at the time for the gold standard, but it seemed like more than one country was on the gold standard. What's the probability that any one nation now would step up and go back on some type of a standard, whether it be a gold standard or a coffee standard even? Is that possible?
Well, more and more people are starting to worry about the U.S. dollar. You've seen the Russians and the Chinese and several other countries recently say, look, we've got to do something. The U.S. dollar's in trouble, and unfortunately, they happen to be right from your point, all of our points of view. Will somebody go to the gold standard unilaterally or a specific fixed contract specifically? I doubt it, because then they're too unique. It's hard for people to do commerce in that sort of thing. Now, it could happen. You could have an enlightened politician somewhere say, we've got to do something to have stable currencies, and someone could do it. I don't see anybody on the horizon even talking about us doing it unilaterally, but why not? If you could find somebody smart enough to do something, it might be a lead for the rest of us.
Robert Baer, former CIA guy, wrote a book. I just read it, called The Devil We Know, and I'm going to get to your book too. It's about dealing with Iran emerging as a superpower, as an empire. In the book, he suggests that Saudi Arabia has much less oil than they suggest, and they overstate what they can produce. He says about 10 years' worth. Is that your thinking, or do you have any idea if that's accurate or not?
Well, I know something's wrong in Saudi Arabia. I know that 5 years ago they promised the world they were going to increase production by 2 or 3 million barrels a day, and I know they have not done it. I know they told George Bush when he was there not long ago that they could not produce any more than they were producing, or much more than they were producing now. I know that in 1979, there was an audit which showed that there were 245 billion barrels of oil in Saudi Arabia. I know in 1988, 10 years later, Saudi Arabia said we have 260 billion barrels. Well, every year since 1988, Saudi Arabia has claimed they have 260 billion barrels of oil. It's astonishing. It never goes up and it never goes down. And that's despite the fact that they have produced something like 70 billion barrels of oil. So I know something is seriously wrong in Saudi Arabia. I've never been to the Saudi oil fields, and even if I had been, I'm not a geologist, so I couldn't tell you. But I know there's a problem. Nobody quite knows what it is because they're so secret. Whether it's 10-year supply or not, I don't know, but I do know something's wrong in Saudi Arabia, which everybody should be prepared for.
Shakespeare said something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
And the state of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, I tend to agree, but I'm more interested in your thoughts here. So I don't want to editorialize, although I have a hair trigger response to want to stick in my two cents. So Iran, in terms of OPEC, Iran is the second largest producer. You know, they have a cook who's shooting his mouth off, but Bear reports that it's really the 12er Shia clerics who control everything, and he's just a rattling saber himself. What do you think of our foreign policy by putting Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in diplomatic relations with Iran to bring them to the table, start treating them serious, and opening trade relations, maybe some of our oil technology, which they need desperately, given their sense of under you know, they've got no work for their people. They got inflation there. And in return, we would have a healthy relationship where we can start importing their oil.
Well, I've never known things to be good when people are shouting at each other and almost trying to come to blows. So open borders and open dialogue and open discussions and open trade, as far as I'm concerned, has always been good for the world, has always been good for the countries involved. So I hope something will come of it. You know, all of that started in Iran started, what, 30 years ago now. And I'm not saying that we're right or they're right or we're right or anything else. I'm just pointing out it's been 30 years since this fight started. Maybe most of those people who started the fight are dead on both sides,
right,
long since out of power. So maybe somebody should look at it with fresh eyes. I don't know what would come of it, but open trade and open borders are always better.
India has just begun its marathon month-long election cycle process. I know maybe as recently as 5-6 months ago you were pretty bearish on India. Is that still the case?
Well, the Indian first of all, I should say India is the most extraordinary country in the world to visit. If you can only visit one country in your lifetime, I would urge you to go to India. However, as far as a place to invest or an economy, it's a mess. I mean, it's a horrible bureaucracy. It's just not terribly developed. They say the right things, or at least they have been saying the right things, but they've never come through. So it's not a place where I want you. If you go to India and do business, you're doing business with the wind at your face, as many even expat Indians are finding when they go back to try to do things. I think I'd rather be in countries where the wind is at my back rather than in my face.
Well,
it is an extraordinary country, let me say. I mean, it's just breathtaking to visit and travel around India.
Yeah, I haven't done your extended traveling, but I have been to India twice for quite a long period of time, actually, and I felt the wind in my face. The regulators change on a whim. It seems like they're using their lucky astrology mood watch to make decisions, and I found it very frustrating, but I thought the people were very unassuming for their skills and very, very nice. 25% of the current parliament there has are up on charges for serious crimes like rape, murder, and kidnapping. Could India benefit from stealing a chapter from China and having something a little bit more authoritarian? Would that help making the country a little bit more wind at your back, or at least wind on hitting your broadside?
Well, you know, Plato in the Republic talked about how countries and nations, societies developed, and he said that usually there is a period when it is good for a country to have, I think you used the word authoritarianism, or strength at the top, so perhaps it would be. Certainly, you know, 1947, when India got independence, they were one of the more successful countries in the world. China was a disaster. Since then, China has run circles around them, despite, or because of, India's democracy, so something needs to change. The democracy is not a very well-functioning democracy, if nothing else. I'm not one to advocate dictatorship or anything else, but I do know that what's happened in India has not been terribly successful compared to some other countries in the world.
I would tend to agree. You know, I love India. I love the Indian people. My best friend lives there. I'm actually going to speak with him after we hang up. But it's just been a very frustrating time to be working there and doing work for the Indian people. I want to change gears and go to your book. As a fan of you and a student of yours, I've read all your books. This one's called The Gift to My Children. It comes out in the U.S. here on the 28th, which is a week away. And this book's a little different from the ones you've written in the past, especially the last one, which I kind of sleep with at night, Hot Commodities and then The Bull on China. How did this one come about?
Well, I came to parenthood late. I didn't become a father until later in life. I used to be very much against children. I thought children were a waste of time. I felt sorry for people who had children. Well, first of all, let me tell you, I was dead wrong. I was totally, unbelievably wrong. These little girls are the most wonderful thing that's ever happened to me, and I urge anybody listening to this show, if they haven't done it, to get home and get on with it, because I'm telling you, this is just a remarkable experience for me. So as I had these little girls and as they started growing up, I kept thinking of all the things I wanted to teach them, and I would teach them, although it didn't do much good when they were one or two or three. So I started writing things down, and then I started putting them in articles or with reporters. And so I said to myself, why don't I just put together a book of all of this stuff, because then they can look at it at any time they want, and it'll help me. I'll think of some of my lessons that I've learned in life. Lessons of life, lessons of investing, just things that will guide these little girls as they get older. So that's how the book developed.
Yeah, and just from like a longevity standpoint, it's a lasting legacy of your thoughts written from you, by you. You know, it's from the heart. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm a parent. I've got two boys. Two of the bullets that stand out are trust your own judgment and focus on what you like.
Well, one of the things I've learned in life, and I'm sure you have too, is that the people who do what they love or who follow their passions are usually more successful than people who are doing something they don't like. And also, even if they're not terribly successful, at least they're happy. I mean, they love getting up in the morning and going to work. They don't go to work, in fact. They just get up and start having fun, and which is one reason they're more successful than other people. So I've learned that in my own life. I've certainly seen it in many other people. I know lots of people who went to Wall Street who didn't really like it, were just there for the money, or went to law school because their parents told them to, or, you know, became accountants because they thought it would be good safety, good stability. And none of them, I mean, many of them are not terribly happy, but the people who love what they're doing just cannot wake up early enough in the morning so they can get going and have fun.
I'm in Los Angeles, and the softs open at 5 o'clock local time, so I'm spit-shined with my coffee at 4:30, quarter to 5 in the morning, and I wouldn't be doing anything else.
You're the perfect example of what I'm talking about.
They told – I remember Wayne Gretzky got traded, the hockey player, of course, from Edmonton Oilers to the Kings, and the salary at the time for him was outstanding at like $2 million a year, and he said, you know, it's so funny. They're willing to pay me $2 million a year for something that I would do for free. And I was just absolutely floored by that, being a hockey wannabe. The book is called The Gift to My Children, A Father's Lessons for Life and Investing, Jim Rogers. It's on Random House. It's due out in a week. I got my Kindle reader, and I can share with you it's going to be right there the day that I can get it. I want to just quickly one or two more questions on financial literacy, and there's been a lot of stuff going on in the media here kind of precipitated by, you know, Jim Cramer and Jon Stewart going at it. I've got my own opinions about the media. What's the best thing for an investor or even a new trader who wants to be like, you know, even at my humble level, not suppose they can't even aspire to your level. What's the best thing that they can do right now in terms of like reading or anything to improve on his or her financial literacy?
Well, first they should only they should do a lot of homework. They should read as much as they can about markets, because these markets, I promise you, are not simple. If they were, everybody would be very, very, very rich. But second, they should start with what they know. Everybody listening to your show knows a lot about something, whether it's automobile mechanics or fashion or gardening or something. Start with what you know, and then expand on that knowledge base, because if you love automobiles, or if you're a mechanic or something, you know, you're going to know more about new products or new improvements long before anybody on Wall Street. And when you see something new and exciting happen, take the next step. Go and find out about the company. Find out whether it would be a good investment or not. And then if you really have done a lot of homework based on your own knowledge, you will probably buy those shares, and you'll know when to sell them as well, long before Wall Street will, because you'll know when something's changing for the worse. So I try to plead with people all the time, stay with what you know. If it's fashion, stay with it. If it's sports, stay with it, because there are fantastic opportunities in every field of life, and if you find them, invest there, and then if you become good at it and love it, then maybe you will eventually expand to other fields. But you don't even need to do that. You only need maybe 10 or 20 great ideas in your whole life to become very, very, very successful. Just stay with those, find those 10 or 20, and don't get bothered with stuff you hear on the radio or on the TV or in the press. Just stay with what you know, and you'll get very, very, very rich.
What could the financial broadcast media do a little differently? I mean, when I listen to them, they're talking about, you know, what do you like? What do you like? What do you like? When I was on NDTV myself and they were being interviewing me in India and then on CNBC Asia, all they wanted to know are stocks. You know, what's the story? What do you like? Do you like Mahindra and Mahindra? Do you like ONGC? Do you like, you know, whatever? And I just thought that was the stupidest question. No one seems to dislike anything at this point.
Well, that's a wonderful insight and a wonderful comment. You're exactly right. And that's one reason I don't watch financial TV, because it is just, you know, one hot tip, one hot tout after another. So it's not a very good way to learn about investing. That's why I suggest that people, you know, do their own reading or do their own research and stay with what they know, because I assure you that most of the people that you see in the media, you're not going to learn a whole lot from it. If they set you thinking, or if they bring up a new idea, which I'm sure you were trying to do, or a new approach or a new view, then sure. But the amount of time you would have to spend watching financial TV to get one or two new thoughts is terribly, terribly wasted. You'd be a lot better off sitting and listening to radio or reading or doing something else.
Last question, I'll let you go. I've read it. I don't know who came up with it, but I've read it. You know, people don't typically get the government they want. They get the government they deserve. You know, we just approved another $5 billion for GM. And frankly, I'll tell you, Professor, not that you care, but I'm angry. I never liked GM. I can't think of my 22 years or so of being in the business that the big three have ever been a good investment. I've never liked the products. I've never driven the cars. Now, this is a trade I don't want to be in. As a professional speculator, I've got the right to not participate. I can sit on my hands and do nothing, and it's totally fine. Now I feel like the government, newly elected government, is going to be giving me a tax bill for something I don't want to be in. I mean, what are these people doing here?
You say you don't care that I'm angry. Well, I assure you I'm as angry, if not more so than you. I'm just absolutely livid and furious. I cannot believe what those people in Washington are doing. They keep bailing out their friends, but they're 300 million American citizens and American taxpayers who are having to foot the bill for people's incompetence. It's just, it's mind-boggling to me. It's horrible economics. It's horrible morality that the rest of us, and many of us, have done the right thing. Many of us have saved our money. Many of us have not bought six houses with no money down. Many of us, you know, just lived in one house or waited for a house that we could afford. And now all of a sudden, all of us who've done the right thing over the past 10, 20, 30 years are having to come to the rescue of a few buffoons on Wall Street and a few incompetents in Detroit. We didn't write those absurd contracts with those automobile companies. And I'm as outraged as you are, if not more so, by what's happening. And I wish we had an option. Unfortunately, we don't have an option because, you know, the people in Washington, is not their money. They spend our money as fast as they can to buy votes.
They need the votes. To their credit, Honig from the Kansas City Fed today came out and said this is ridiculous. And another one of my heroes, Joe Stiglitz, back at Columbia, said that, you know, forget them being too big to fail. They're too big to save, and they're too big to even manage.
They are. It's just it's an outrage what's happened, and we would all be better off if they fail, because then they could be reorganized. You could get rid of some of their absurd practices. You know, 50 years ago, a CEO of General Motors said something like, if it's good for General Motors, it's good for America. Well, let me tell you, what's good for America is for General Motors to fail and go bankrupt. So he should take one step further and let them fail and start over.
Well, that's a little – I remember reading about that. I remember Lee Iacocca getting on with his horrible Reliant K and Reliant J cars, which were about as junky as anything I've ever seen on the road, and him saying, you know, lead, follow, or get out of the way. I think it's about time that we take them out back and shoot them like old Yeller. It's sad, and it's – I don't like seeing people not being able to pay their bills or whatever, but the one thing I remember from Robert Mundell's class in international trade is that labor migrates. And, you know, these people have transferable skills. They can probably find something else to work on instead of horrible American cars, which have never been a good investment.
Right. You're exactly right. And look, when you say you don't like people, you can't pay, it's not good that people can't pay. I agree 100%. But remember, it's not right that they take money from you and me and give it to somebody else to pay their bills when we've done the right things. We have, you know, safety nets now. We can take care of the people who get into trouble. And as you point out, labor can migrate. They can move to other areas of the country, other jobs. It may be a short period of hardship, but we have enough safety nets now that we try to take care of everybody. But it is outrageous that you and I are going to have to pay for people who made mistakes.
Well, I remember taking a class. It was called The History of Revolution, and we studied revolutions. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, this would be really horrible to have something like the Civil War. But when I go back and look at my notes, because I'm one of those kind of guys who writes notes, write them down, and I read them, and I go back and I read them. I reread your chapter in Market Wizards probably about 5,000 times. I got more dog ears in there than I've seen at a dog pound. And I'm kind of in fear that if things keep going the way they're going, you know, we might be looking at some form of financial reformation or some kind of revolution here in the States if things start to unwind. I mean, I'm not spooked to the point where I'm going and buying a gun, but damn, it just doesn't stop. The bad news every day is like...
You're starting to see social unrest in several countries around the world already. If it gets as bad as it could and as bad as I think it might be, I am afraid you will see some social unrest in the United States. You're already starting to see tent cities developed in many cities, which we haven't had in America in over 70 years. So be prepared. Yes, I can see social unrest if things get worse, and the people in Washington continue to make it worse. And there are many people who are getting angrier and angrier, including you and me. I mean, not just the people who cannot pay their bills are angry now, but many of the rest of us who are suffering because of what Washington is doing, we too are getting angry. So it's not that strange a concept. I hope it doesn't happen. I hope that things get better and better quickly. Unfortunately, what I see Washington doing, I don't see it happening. So we should all be prepared for the fact that we could have social unrest in the U.S. We've had it before. It can happen again.
Well, I'm out of questions. I mean, I could sit and talk with you all day because, you know, there's anything that I read in The Economist, I could probably pick up the phone and chat with you about. You know, as a trader, I'm a little younger than you, but I would just like to thank you for being a good role model. I'd also like to thank you for being so available. You know, there's a lot of guys who are in your league that are kind of too cool for school, and I firmly believe there's something called intellectual greed. And you're out there teaching. I teach. You know, I don't know where my class would rank against yours, but I'm giving back to the community because everybody needs access and everybody needs a mentor. And just wanted to thank you very much.
Well, I hope you keep up your teaching or helping other people, and you say nice things about me, but really I'm just a simple person. I'm a simple person from a small town in the South, so I'm no different from anybody else. So let's do it again sometime.
Sure, dude. Thank you, Professor. Thanks for your time, and Godspeed.